afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Amy Phillips. Coming up in the next hour for you, we meet some medical students who are on an O-week of sorts, spending time in regional hospitals to hopefully whet their appetite for bush practice.
To excite them by seeing real rural experiences, real rural doctors, they're certainly getting that this week.
A central Queensland community has rallied to help a beekeeper rebuild after losing his home and beehives during the Deepwater bushfires, to then also be hit with losing a family member. That story soon. And we walk the catwalk. Come with us on the Salyard catwalk, that is, and check out prices at the big weaner cattle sales in Victoria. First up today on the Country Hour, though, Cotton Australia says the recent fish deaths over the border in the Barwon-Darling River system at Menindee are a devastating sight, but says it's wrong to blame cotton growers for this incident, especially this season, which is shaping up to be very lean across the growing regions. CEO Adam Kay says purposeful misinformation is also unhelpful.
There's clear evidence that we're dealing with the drought. You know, it's there's no secret about the drought that's been ravaging the country. And just yesterday, the Bureau of Meteorology came out and said that this has been the seventh driest year in the Murray-Darling Basin since they've been keeping records. And if you look at actually over the last 2 years, some parts of the basin catchment where it's been the driest on record. So, it's clearly there's not much water out there in the system, unfortunately, and that's impacting agriculture, it's impacting the river. It's a devastating time for everyone.
Has Cotton Australia done enough in terms of advocating that message? The looks of social media, the looks of Twitter at the moment maybe would make me suggest no.
We've been out there and sharing that message. I think what we've come up against at the moment is where we're at in the political cycle, and New South Wales has an election coming up in March, and federally there's an election coming up, so we're seeing people trying to sort of make a name for themselves and suggesting they know what's going on, and South Australian senators, often Green senators, where you can slam an industry that's not in your state and it's a free kick, and that's what we're seeing. No facts, but just that sort of innuendo, and that's why we're getting on the front foot and we're just letting people know that that's not the case. It's the cotton industry is impacted just like everyone else. And when you look at places like Bourke on the Barwon-Darling, there's no cotton there this year. You look at Dirranbandi, I think it's growing about 1% of what it would grow in a good season. So, the idea that the cotton took all the water is just not on. We really want people to understand that and, get out west of the range and come and have a look. We're an open, transparent industry. We want people to have a look at that.
Has the cotton industry seen such a lean time for the likes of Bourke, Dirranbandi? Have you seen that before?
Yeah, we have. I think that's the thing with the northern part of the Murray-Darling Basin, which is the Darling part of the system. It's an ephemeral system. It's a bit boom and bust. When it rains, there's big floods, and when there's not, the river dries up. And you just go back and look at all the records of the riverboat captains on the Darling. There'd be times where they'd be stranded in places for years, and then the flood had come and they'd get back downstream.
No wonder they went out of business.
Exactly. But it's an ephemeral system. Whereas when you get down into the southern part of the basin, down on the Murray, Murrumbidgee, that's fed by snowmelt, and so it's a much more reliable system. It's a different type of system. The Darling only contributes about 15% of the water to the Murray-Darling catchment.
Let's look across some of the key growing regions in Queensland. Central Queensland's about to kick off their cotton harvest. What can we expect out of there?
Yeah, well, look, they've really been enjoying the ability to have a more open cotton planting window, and a fair amount of their crop went in August, and the earliest planted, we're going to start seeing picked in over the weekend and next week. So it's quite an exciting time. Growers are always apprehensive before the pickers go in there, those big big green lie detectors that tell you what the yield's going to be. But I think they're quietly confident that there's a good crop there. There's been some heat waves. It's knocked a little bit of fruit off the plant, but you know, I think they're expecting some, you know, average to above average yields.
And what are you being told about the Darling Downs?
Well, look, the Darling Downs, you know, we've seen, an increase in the amount of dry land planted, you know, based on those falls. You know, some people, you know, they were very variable falls. You know, there was up to 300 millimetres in some spots. Other people only get 50 or 60 millimetres. But, you know, that has enabled, you know, some additional planting of dry land. In fact, there's more dry land on the downs than irrigated. And that's something for people to note too across the whole industry. You know, the percentage of dry land cotton is way up. As people try and, a lot of areas they haven't had winter crop and they're trying to generate cash flow, and cotton returns are good at the moment.
They certainly are, and fingers crossed we do get some rain on that dryland cotton. Central Queensland starting their harvest this weekend, maybe not so much some rain there if you're trying to get the picker out of the shed. Now, staying with cotton and the cost of a devastating storm that wiped out infrastructure and crops at the Australian Cotton Research Institute in northern New South Wales last month is being realised. Large hail and severe wind up to 150 kilometres an hour, I hear, impacted the Narrabri Research Centre in December, costing already $2 million in damages. Director Rod Jackson told Madeline Lewis, most of the field-based research has been destroyed and the impact will be felt throughout the cotton industry.
We're looking at damage to main buildings, air conditioning systems, greenhouses, glasshouses, you know, roofs, roofing removed, doors blown in, that sort of thing. So it was quite a significant storm cell. Fortunately, we've got a fantastic team here on the station, support team that we've been able to restore business continuity. So most of our laboratory and glasshouse, greenhouse programs have been restored, albeit, you know, there's still damage to infrastructure, but we've been able to resurrect that research. So, you know, obviously we've got some challenging times ahead.
What exactly was being worked on within the research program?
So typically we do research in plant breeding, agronomy, irrigation, cotton disease, diagnostics, insect pest management type programs we've got running. The field-based programs have been hit harder, so obviously we've had 100% defoliation on most of the cotton, albeit some of the cotton has come back. The early planted cotton is not, we've still got plant stands there that will be useful for some sort of research. Obviously the viability of the research has been compromised, but working with our research partners, particularly Cotton Research Development Corporation, we're looking at ways we can salvage and use the plant stands to look at some of the treatment effects of the hail. You know, that might be a benefit to industry going forward. So we're looking at every aspect of those research trials to see what we can salvage. And obviously that's a conversation with our research partners.
The ACRI, it impacts on the development of new varieties and production practices, etc. Will that slow anything down in terms of that?
Yes, Maddie. Well, for those in industry are probably already aware, but for those that are not industry, for a CSIRO to develop a new variety, you know, your timeline's typically 10 years. So obviously the challenges that CSIRO face in their plant breeding program are quite significant. You know, it's going to be a 12-month delay and potentially down the track in terms of their ability to deliver those new varieties. But I guess the reality is there's just nothing, you know, either agency can do about the storm event. We're just going to move on and try and salvage what we can and move forward.
Rod Jackson, director of the Narrabri-based Australian Cotton Research Institute, which copped it in a storm in late December. It's 12:15.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
And it's still raining nicely in the wet tropics regions above, you know, Townsville and that typical Tully area, as well as around Mackay. I can see 163 millimetres has fallen at Hawkins Creek and still raining there. Sukrajan Weir, which is below Mackay, 113 millimetres in the 24 hours till 9 a.m. this morning. We'll have a chat about more rainfall soon with the Weather Bureau. But a small community has rallied to help out a honey farmer who lost his home and livelihood in last year's Central Queensland bushfires. But this week, the local community chipped in to help him take the first steps towards recovery. Sarah Jane Bell reports.
6 weeks on from the devastating bushfires in Deepwater, the bees have returned, but they're missing their keeper. George Spiteri took 12 years to develop his honey business, but it was gone within minutes when the fire ripped through his property.
I was forced to leave because the conditions got very dangerous to stay here. The heat that was coming off the fire was very intense, and I willingly left, but then I wasn't able to come back. So it was about 10 days or more before I was able to have a good look at what actually happened here.
Tell me what you saw when you came back.
Total destruction, basically. There was virtually nothing left. Yeah, it was I've never seen anything like it before, really. And I still am a bit taken aback by just what has happened. Basically, I think when the honey caught fire and ran out the shed, it caused the house to catch fire.
George believes the overall damage bill to his property and business will be more than $2 million.
Things were starting to look really good, and I had a fair bit of honey stored in the shed, and I ended up losing all of it. I had about 20 tonnes. That was pretty much our work for 6 months. I don't think there'll be much locally this year. Might be 2020 before things start to fire around here again. I think a lot of the trees actually look like they've died because they haven't started to shoot yet.
George says he's thankful the community is with him to take the first steps towards recovery.
Very grateful that so many people are here helping with the clean-up, and there's only a bit that they can do, but it's a lot, really, because it's a start for me, and it'll get the momentum going. It's a bit more encouragement when I come here and I see so much done. It's a bit of encouragement.
Despite the sweltering heat, the property was a hive of activity yesterday as 50 community members gathered for a working bee to help clean up what's left of the farm. Rosedale resident Mick Hine says it's not unusual to see the community band together like this.
Well, mate, just when you hear one of your mates gets into a bit of difficulty, and George has built many dams for people all throughout the community, especially mine, and when you hear the devastation and see the destruction, well, that's what we do as a community. We're only a phone call away, and most of the community is exactly the same, just a phone call away.
Tragically, it wasn't the only loss the family faced last year. His former wife and the mother of George's young sons died in an unrelated incident shortly after the fire. Here's one of the volunteers, Saskia Forks.
As you know, they've just lost their mum just before Christmas. So they know that they're not alone, that we are a family, even though we're not blood related. We're a family for them, that if they do need us, they're only young. They're the same age as our son. So I would hate for my son to lose me. So we've got to be there for them.
With the hard work underway, George says he hopes to return home soon.
The day after the fire, the bees started to recover, so I've got to hurry up, otherwise I'll get left behind.
A sweet end to a tragic set of circumstances.
Sarah Jane Bell reporting from Deepwater, 6 weeks after those devastating bushfires.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, Queensland is earning praise from the likes of the World Health Organisation for its efforts to get more doctors to take up permanent jobs in the bush. The Rural Generalist Pathway Program has seen hundreds of regional GP positions being filled, with towns like Emerald in central Queensland this year boasting a near full contingency of permanent doctors. Now, there's an effort to keep that momentum up by sending medical students out west earlier in their studies. Theodore Doctor and Head of Rural and Remote Medicine for the University of Queensland, Dr. Bruce Chater, says it's been a really busy week for 50 students who've been based at regional centres such as Gundawindi, Kingaroy, Theodore and Roma.
So in a couple of weeks I'll be heading to Cherbourg, and honestly I'm looking for...
That's not the good doctor. Let me get that for you in a moment. If I press this... Here we go. Here's Dr. Bruce Chater from Theodore.
And it's about taking rural students, taking metro ones, giving them some rural experience, giving them more rural experience, and then a clear pathway. And we're very fortunate in Queensland to have the Rural Generalist Pathway, which now is taking our students further on. and they've graduated 122 now into rural areas, and they've got 360 trainees. So we're the feeder into that, and the way you get the students to onto that pathway is to excite them by seeing real rural experiences, real rural doctors, and I think they're certainly getting that this week.
What can the bush bring? Remind us what the bush can do for rural doctors that they can't get in the city.
The reason I went to Theodore in the first place was because I wanted a breadth of experience. And certainly some doctors prefer to narrow their craft into smaller areas, but for many doctors, having that breadth of experience, being able to do a broad range of things from general practice through to more procedural medicine and follow those patients through, being able to understand what the real needs of a rural person are and being able to follow them into the hospital and out of the hospital, that's really inspiring. The barrier in the past was just getting sufficient training for people that they were confident and competent to do it. UQ's very much committed to delivering that to our students. That's why we're teaching them reasonably advanced skills early on in their training to give them that buzz of being able to understand that they can do this later on, and then giving them the chance to choose whether they want to become rural generalists and populate our towns with competent doctors.
What's the retention rate? You mentioned 120 doctors have gone through the Rural Generalist Program just recently. How many of them do you believe will stay west of the divide?
Well, there's 122 who are still there at the moment and 360 who are out training. Even if only half of them stay, we're a whole lot better off. We're 250 better off than we were beforehand. And you can actually see, I know the workforce issue in most of the rural towns, and a lot of the rural towns are actually filling up now with rural doctors. Emerald's a great example. We've got a great leader there in Ewan McPhee, who's the president of the College of Rural and Remote Medicine. And yeah, they were in a parlous state 5 years ago with almost completely a locum workforce. And I don't think there's any vacancies now in Emerald. It's all a young, vibrant and well-skilled workforce there now.
That's Dr. Bruce Chater, Theodore Doctor and Head of Rural and Remote Medicine for the University of Queensland. Well, UQ medical students Grace Boyd and Joshua Shee are just about to start their third year of studies. And whilst they come from Brisbane and the Sunshine Coast respectively, they say they're really looking forward to their first venture into rural Queensland.
So in a couple of weeks, I'll be heading to Cherbourg, and honestly, I'm looking forward to all the experiences that I can have out there. I'm sure it'll be eye-opening to say the least, but I'm up for the challenge, I guess.
Have you ever been to Western Queensland?
No, never.
Grace, where are you heading?
So I'm heading out to Roma, which I'm very excited about, and hopefully I'll be able to experience some work with the RFDS as well, which is very, very exciting and would be just an incredible opportunity.
What's the reputation of being a clinician or, you know, a practitioner in Western Queensland from a student's perspective? What do you guys hear?
Well, we often hear that the lifestyle is actually incredible and the ability to actually connect with the patients that you're seeing and build some actual difference in their lives is a fantastic opportunity that you don't necessarily get in the metropolitan areas. Of course, it comes with that separation from metropolitan area, but at the end of the day, it's up to you what you think is valuable. And I think that community connection is what's really valuable there.
Great.
For sure. And for me, I think it's a wonderful opportunity because you get to see so much. And for example, as a rural generalist, which is something that I'm quite interested in, it's not just being a GP, but you can specialise in other areas like obstetrics, and you get to do some surgical procedures as well. So you get that whole well-rounded balance of everything that you might want, but you can't have in, you know, a metropolitan area.
Do you see many students before you going bush and staying out there? Like, is it a well-worn path?
Absolutely. I mean, the way that even our university is structured says that we all go out there, and even if you look at the statistics of it, yep, people that go out there generally tend to stay out there, which is fantastic. And I think that comes back to those community connections that people form. You know, once you get a taste of that ability to actually make differences in these patients' lives, you can't get enough of it.
You touched on it before, I think, Grace, but you will see things out in rural areas that you won't get the opportunity to in bigger let's say, metropolitan mm-hmm. hospitals?
Yeah. So I think we'll see a lot more chronic disease out there, and obviously the patients that need to get transferred to Brisbane as well. So like we were chatting about earlier today, it gives us an opportunity to really understand what it's like for those patients when we are in Brisbane and we're treating those patients that have travelled so far in Brisbane. And we can really understand it from their point of view and what it's like to come from so far.
Have you both had time, though, in big metropolitan hospitals? Have you done placements there?
Yeah, so both of us have spent the last 12 months in either the PA or the Royal Brisbane Hospital in the middle of Brisbane, so it doesn't get much busier than that.
No. Absolutely. What did you like about that? What's luring in terms of that lifestyle for young doctors, do you think?
Look, the fact that it is so busy means that the excitement's non-stop, right? You've got a lot of different patients coming in, new, exciting and different things from all across Queensland being drawn to that one location because that's where the specialists seem to be centred around.
And new and exciting technologies as well. But, true. You know, it's forever expanding in places like Toowoomba where the technology is coming out here. So we can experience that now here as well.
And telehealth is nearly beating you out too,
exactly.
You know, western parts. And in any way, are there incentives? Like the teaching, Queensland Education provide extra points if you go bush and do your time out in western parts. Is there any incentive scheme, obviously other than financial, that is within health?
For students, I think there's definitely an incentive. Like I was saying, there's far less students here compared to the metropolitan areas, so you get much greater time with your tutors or your clinicians and all of that in the hospital, and there's less patient fatigue as well, which we hear a lot about in Brisbane because there's so many students trying to get the experiences with the patients and practice and everything. So I think out here it's going to be incredible because we'll have so many more opportunities for that.
Good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
Joshua Shee and Grace Boyd, both UQ medical students, soon heading to Cherbourg and Roma hospitals for hands-on experience. We might try and see if we can catch up with them after they come back from the likes of those hospitals. It's nearly 12:30. The ABC Haywire program presents personal stories from young Australians and the conversations that shape their communities. Haywire winner Hayden Dibella from Ingham in Queensland, obviously, here in the heartland of where it's raining right now, he talks about diversifying the family farm, growing sweet potatoes in a sugarcane town.
Haywire. Stories of life in regional Australia.
Hayden Dibella, Ingham, Queensland.
I've always liked plants. I had my first garden when I was 5. Luckily, I'm surrounded by plants. My family are farmers. I have been going with Dad on the tractor for most of my life. I live near Ingham in tropical North Queensland on a beautiful property along the Herbert River. Ingham is a sugar town. My family grows sugarcane, but the sugar price is very low. So I have a plan. One day, while I was going up and down the rows in Dad's tractor, I realised Ingham cannot rely on sugarcane anymore. The sugar industry in Ingham has been going for hundreds of years. The soil in Ingham is tired and needs a break from cane. I thought, what if we grew something totally different? Like sweet potatoes. No one else in Ingham grows sweet potatoes, but I told Dad my idea. Dad is an agronomist. We decided to give it a go. I love seeing the plants germinate and grow into fully ripened plants and then go to harvest. I've always wanted to work on the farm. Together we planted my first small crop of sweet potatoes to see which varieties grow best in North Queensland. I researched what equipment we needed and monitored our test crops. We decided to plant the white and purple sweet potatoes. I found some second-hand equipment, so it didn't cost as much. At the end of the year, I'm going to plant my clean seed of sweet potatoes, and next year I would like to plant my full 10 acres of sweet potatoes. I would like to set up the old shed at home to run all my washing equipment. Hopefully, I can make enough money to afford my sweet potato harvester. One day, I would like to grow a family farm, expanding our small property over more acres. I'm excited to grow our family business and provide more opportunities for our farm and family. But to grow, we can't just plant the same crops over and over again, like we have always done. We need to diversify. Our sweet potato experiment isn't just about us. Hopefully, growing different sweet potato crops will help the town of Ingham.
Haywire! Hayden, that was lovely. Hayden Dibella from Ingham, who's having a go at sweet potatoes. Go to abc.net.au/haywire to read and listen to Hayden's story and 36 other winners from across the country. It's 12:30. Soon on the Country Hour, cattle work in the rain is a privilege, many would say, but it also complicates things. We head to a Central Queensland station trying to complete its artificial insemination program. And Godolphin, it's a name that hit the news after the big United Arab Emirates thoroughbred stud's horse, Cross Counter, won the Melbourne Cup. We chat to the head of the stud, who's poking around at the moment at the Gold Coast yearling sales at the Magic Millions. First up, though, time to check what's making news around the state. Good afternoon, Jodie Gundas.
Good afternoon, Amy. A 56-year-old bricklayer who died at a Sunshine Coast construction site on Thursday may have suffered a medical condition as investigators returned to the Maroochydore site today. The man is understood to have been working near a stairwell before the fall at about 2:30. Critical care paramedics were unable to revive the man. The contracting firm has voluntarily shut down at the site in Maroochydore as Workplace Health and Safety Queensland investigators visit the scene. A metre-long green sea turtle has astounded conservationists and residents of a North Queensland harbour after it wandered 400 metres from the beach to a residential area. Steve Fisher from the Mackay Turtle Watch Group was called to relocate the turtle after a local resident found it in his driveway. Mr. Fisher says it's likely it became disoriented after a storm after coming ashore to nest. Disoriented indeed. Amy, more news coming up at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Jodie Gundas. Let's check the weather forecast. It's a very good afternoon to Rick Threlfall from the Bureau. How are you? Rick Threlfall, can you hear me? Once again, I can hear them. Let me bring you some rainfall figures while hopefully Jodie rectifies the situation. It's still raining in North Queensland. There's been 36 millimetres since 9 a.m. at Peacock Siding Alert, 54 millimetres in the gauge at Ingham Depot Alert since 9 a.m. this morning, 20 millimetres at Paluma Dam, 16 millimetres at Jeppoon Vale, and 115 millimetres has been recorded all up at Eyre, 150 millimetres at Glendale near Upper Stone, 100 millimetres in the gauge all up in the last couple of days at Macnade in the Lowen Herbert, 40 millimetres in the gauge overnight at Green Hills near Georgetown. So nice to see it trying to get into the Gulf. And 123 millimetres at Mount Fox near Ingham overnight. Let's try Rick Threlfall, ready to go on the phone. I've got to press this button. G'day, Rick. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Amy. Got there in the end.
My apologies. Where can people expect some rain this afternoon?
Yeah, through the course of the afternoon, really going to see that rainfall of showers and thunderstorms really just over the far north of the state. We've still got that heavy rainfall around the Ingham area that's been very slow moving during the night and is still pretty slow moving at the moment. But that trough that's giving that heavy rainfall in that area should gradually shift northward through the course of the day very slowly. So it'll take that heavier rainfall a little bit further north towards Cardwell, Tully later on today and up towards Innisfail this evening. But all across the far north of the state, really through the Cape and the Gulf Country, you're going to see quite a rash of showers and thunderstorms. There's already quite a lot of showers and storms developing in that area. And we could see some likely heavy falls across the far north around the peninsula, northern parts of the Gulf Country in thunderstorms today. And through the north tropical coast district, sort of around the Tablelands, you could see some fairly decent showers and thunderstorms there this afternoon. But once you come south of that line, a lot quieter. We've got a ridge of high pressure up the east coast. So Townsville, unfortunately, missed out on a lot of the heavier rainfall. Is probably only going to see one or two showers, brief showers, if anything at all, through today. The heaviest of the rainfall has been to the south of them and to the north of them, but again, they've missed out, unfortunately. But yeah, along a lot of the east coast, just one or two showers on in the onshore flow for the next few days. And even the showers and thunderstorms across the far north of the state will gradually ease off over the weekend. Still quite a few storms over the peninsula tomorrow and through the Gulf Country around Burketown, Normanton, but that should weaken off during Sunday. And a large part of the state will become mostly fine, really, over the weekend. Just a little bit of shower activity around the northeastern tropics, but a lot of the east coast will become fine through the weekend, and a lot of the interior of the state should be fine over the weekend as well, and becoming increasingly hot over the interior of the state, particularly the middle part of next week. We see quite hot conditions really spreading from the west all the way through the southern interior, getting into the southeastern interior through next week, so about 5 to 8 degrees above average. So heating up over the interior of the state, but generally the heavy rainfall over parts of the north will be easing off over the next day or so.
Spare a thought for Birdsville. Friday, Saturday, 44 degrees. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, 45 degrees. 45 again Wednesday. 46 on Thursday. Does that come inland? Oh, so further east much? It is penetrating, as you say, across most of the state, that warmer weather?
Yeah, it really will start to come eastwards, mainly sort of the middle to latter part of next week.
Yep.
So for the next few days, that heat is really sort of confined to the Channel Country and the southern interior. But once we get to around the middle part of next week, it'll be getting all the way to Toowoomba, to Gatton. Gatton will be about 8 degrees above average by the time it's next Thursday, getting up to 40 degrees, by the time it's next Thursday. So those temperatures into the 40s, potentially spreading into the Lockyer Valley by the time we get to the end of next week. So certainly heating up right the way across the south as we get through next week.
Brussels sprouts. What are your longer range forecasts telling you? You know, your 14 days, anything on the horizon for Queensland, rain-wise, obviously?
Not looking really too significant, even once you go further ahead. A lot of the interior of the state is still looking fine, and the heat is probably going to become the main factor looking a little bit further ahead. So towards the end of next week and the beginning of the following week, still mostly fine over a large part of the state. A little bit of shower activity along the east coast, but it looks like we're going to, much of the state is sort of quiet weather spell, no sign of any cyclones or anything like that, but unfortunately just remaining dry over the interior of the state. Up until around about the 21st of January, still look very dry over the interior of the state.
I was of the impression we're in the wet season.
Well, yeah, I mean, some parts of the state, particularly over the north, have certainly had that.
Totally.
But it has been mainly around that sort of northeastern tropics, and everywhere else has been pretty dry in the last few weeks at least.
Rick Threlfall from the Bureau, thank you for your time.
Cheers, thanks, Amy.
Rick Threlfall at the Weather Bureau there in Brisbane.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Staying with rain, and apparently it doesn't make cows feel very romantic. For Clermont grazier Josie Angus, the rainfall received from ex-tropical cyclone Penny has been slowing down her artificial insemination program. But you won't hear anyone on the property of Kimberley Station complaining, and Josie told Melanie Groves just how the country is looking post that rain.
It's looking amazing. We've been very blessed. We got some storm rain in December, you know, which was extremely patchy at that stage. So we were really fortunate to get under a decent fall then. And Penny last night has bought us another 17 mils, and it's truly remarkable, you know, how nature, how resilient she can be. You know, you can be 30 days away from grey and despair, and all of a sudden, you know, you're knee deep in buffle grass. It's pretty amazing.
And I have to admit, we felt some of that rain from Penny as we drove in through a bit of the mud this morning to get here. Tell me, how well is the country and land actually recovering from the dry period?
It has recovered really well. By the mud on the ABC car, you know, the moisture profile is really strong, and it is, no, you know, the grass has recovered really well. You know, we're kind of busily trying to shuffle cattle and keep them on the move so that our grass has the best chance of recovery that it can be. So now, it's a speed game, kind of, you know, give them a paddock and then shuffle them along and things like that, you know, but nature's doing a pretty awesome job of recovery by herself as well. So, yeah.
And there's definitely no rest for the wicked, moving cattle from paddock to paddock. There's also a few other things happening here on Kimberley today. What are you guys up to today?
So at the moment, Tess Cam, who, you know, doubles as GM of our beef company, is also, so she and my daughters are running an AI program with some heifers here. So 4 o'clock starts and watching heifers and late evenings. They all came home rather sodden last night after watching at dusk. But so yeah, they're watching dawn, dusk and lunchtime and just trying to introduce, a few heritage genetics back in and genetics that, you know, that we don't have here on farm.
It would definitely make people doing the work a little bit sodden. But as well, how does the rain actually impact the heifers when you're trying to do AI?
We definitely don't do a lot of AI. It's something that we use intermittently to, you know, just when we're looking to introduce something new. But it was interesting, you know, it did definitely dampen the, no pun intended, dampen the activity. You know, the heifers were probably more concerned with turning their backs to the rain than, you know, than focusing on how frisky they were feeling. But anyway, we'll take the green grass every day of the week.
It is still, it's still sort of in what you'd call regularly the wet season here in this region. Is this the time of the year that you're looking at joining your heifers during this wet season?
That's right. So we generally join our general herd, so last week of January to the 1st of February, and that's when our bulls generally go out with the herd. You know, we're looking to kind of make sure that peak lactation lines up, you know, with the, you know, the best nutrition that we can offer. You know, we're looking to have, you know, hopefully those calves hitting the ground fairly coincident with the early storms. And, you know, particularly, I mean, down here we could probably, you know, we historically used to actually join in December, and, you know, that still works fine. But when we bought Carpentaria Downs in the north, and, you know, those windows are a little tighter to make sure that you get that right in terms of really achieving, you know, our fertility targets up there. So 1st of February works brilliantly at Carpentaria, and so we've moved our program down here to match.
Always interesting to hear how people run their places. That's Josie Angus from Kimberley Station at Clermont speaking with Melanie Groves. And I understand the ABC car needs a bit of a wash today, a bit of mud, a bit of slip and sliding, which is, you know, what we're here for as rural reporters. Now, staying with beef, and it's hard to believe, but it was once considered an undesirable breed. These days, Angus cattle are among the top contenders dominating the beef market here and abroad. And this year marks the centenary of Angus Australia, and the Society has a full year of events to mark the milestone. The first record of black cattle imported was of a handful unloaded at Hobart in the 1800s, while the Breed Society was established in 1919. The breed's come a long way, and there's still more to come. So Lara Webster got some thoughts from the next generation, 14-year-old Benjamin and 12-year-old Thomas Duddy, who were preparing one of their heifers for the Angus Youth Roundup event in New South Wales this weekend.
This is my heifer here, which I'm taking to Roundup. She's 15 months old. I think she's just so structurally correct, this cow. She's very feminine. That's just what I love about this cow. She's just that showy type. And she's just got beautiful capacity in her.
Oh, well, I think what you got to admire about this heifer that we've got in front of us here is a phenotype, and she's very lengthy in the body. She's thick through the stifle. She tracks very well. She's got a perfect udder. She's got lovely neck extension, and she's got lovely capacity and volume, and she's a very nice heifer in my opinion.
You already sound like a judge.
This year I actually had my first dual judging at Austinville Show. And on top of that, I've won quite a few judging competitions, and so I've done a bit of it.
Sounds like you have. You've got Angus Youth Roundup coming up. You've been there a few times. Tell me what you learn when you head along to events like that.
I think you just learn. You learn. You get more experience in showing and preparing cattle and judging cattle. And I think the way they run all the different educational classes is a great way to educate the youth. And you learn about all the different meat cuts and MSA and all that sort of stuff. And I just think it's a great educational opportunity where they have other people that are very experienced cattle operators come and talk to you about the industry and teach you how to fit cattle. And I think it's just a great opportunity for the youth to be educated.
What about you, Thomas?
I think it's just an amazing opportunity with the awards, what they have. You can, there are some awards where you can win a heifer. There are some awards where you can go overseas and get opportunities from people who live in a different climate. They breed cattle different ways, and you can see how they breed cattle different to us, and maybe can bring some stuff that you've learnt from over there back to Australia. It's all just about bringing the next generation on in the Angus society.
And you are the next generation, so tell me, what is it about Angus cattle that seems to have you guys hooked?
Well, I think the best thing about Angus cattle is the fact that everyone will take them. So all the feedlots and processors, they all want black cattle in today's world. Whether if you got a Hereford animal, not all feedlots and processors will take a Hereford animal, but the best thing about the Angus is everyone wants black cattle because of their superior beef that they're producing. And I just love the market suitability, the way all the markets will take them, and I think they're the superior cattle.
Yeah, I think they're very nice cattle. Obviously the market, they have a massive market for Angus cattle, probably a little bit more than other breeds. Like if you go to the feedlots these days, there'll be more Angus. But Angus has their place in the market, so do other breeds. Angus, they're just a lovely breed.
Where do you guys see the future is for the industry? I mean, you get to help your parents make some decisions. They already include you in the decision-making here at this operation. What do you see as the future of the breed?
I think the breed's got a lot of future, I really do. I mean, the next 100 years of the Angus Society will be a good 100 years.
Yeah, I pretty much the same as Ben said. I think they do have a lot of future, the Angus cattle, in the next 100 years and so on from the next 100 years. They're just a superior breed. They've just got everything someone would want. Like they came over from Scotland to Tasmania. They've been run in hard conditions, and over in America, they're a strong breed.
The breed's certainly in good hands if Thomas and Benjamin Duddy stick with it. The Angus Youth Roundup event is taking place in Armidale. It starts today. It's the first of a number of centenary events to come this year. Good luck, boys, in that event.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's nearly 10 to 1. Could Australia be the next powerhouse of the international racing world? The head of international bloodstock for the richest thoroughbred operation in the world, Godolphin, says Australasia is poised to become the future of racing. John Godson is visiting the Magic Millions yearling sale on the Gold Coast for the first time right now. He told Hilary Castle he's impressed with what he sees.
Well, I've been singularly impressed by the quality of horses, both the colts and the fillies. They're beautifully presented by the stud farms that bring them up with all of their staff. And I've been very much overwhelmed by the professionalism of it. The Magic Millions people are really, really very welcoming. We're here from all around the world. Great friends of mine from America are here, as well as obviously from Hong Kong and even friends from France and Ireland. So there's plenty of us here. And I just think the way that the whole format works here is very encouraging. There's great depth in the market from individual owners to syndicate owners and all the trainers and all the bloodstock agents are here. So it's a great atmosphere and a wonderful marketplace.
And of course, some great prices there on the first day, four over $1 million. But that what you were talking about before, that strong contingent of international buyers, does that say something about the Australian thoroughbred industry?
Very much so. There's no doubt that I first came here in the 80s, and I admit I've not been back enough since. And I've never been here to the Magic Millions in the Queensland before. But I'm very much aware that the breeding and the quality of the horses here and the pedigrees has increased dramatically. And I very strongly feel that Australasia is very much the whole future of horse racing in this century we're in now. And I'm not saying we're in a demise in Europe or America, but we wouldn't be expanding businesses. And I think to that extent, everything that's going on here is very exciting. And I particularly think that the way the jurisdictions are run, the prize money levels, and the fact that anyone can get involved at any level is incredibly important.
And you mentioned the US and Europe. And I know years ago when I was involved in the thoroughbred industry, it was a time where people would go to the US or even Ireland to, expand their skills in the thoroughbred industry. So is that a possibility for people to come here now? Do you think it's strong enough?
Yes, I do very much think it is very much that. My son is, when he wanted to train, the first place to send him was here to Australia. And he was with David Hayes, and he's been back again at the sales here, and he's with me here now. So I see it very much as the future here. Nothing wrong with America or Europe, of course. Lots of good families, good horses, good traditions there. But I wouldn't see it as strong and as growing as much as it is here in Australia.
You, of course, probably would have heard about extensive drought we've had over the last 12 months throughout Queensland and also throughout New South Wales in one of the biggest thoroughbred nurseries in the Hunter Valley. Were you a bit surprised about the quality so far? Did you think that that would have an impact, or were you told that it could possibly have an impact?
I suppose I expected to see it have a greater impact than it has. The horses look exceptionally well grown and beautifully conditioned, and to that extent, I suppose, a good bone on them. And I suppose I go back to a great old owner breeder in America, Tartan Farms, a man called John Nerud, and he died at the ripe old age of 103. And I remember him telling me way back in the 80s, he had a drought year in Kentucky. He said, boy, the best and toughest horses are born in the drought years. So to that extent, I remember now what he said.
Do you think there's more of a spotlight because of Winx? I mean, coming from overseas, has it created more of a stir about our industry over there?
Well, I think, to have a super race mare like her, sort of a filly for the ages, is important. And I meet the owners in Ascot and England and London, and she has been a phenomenal banner raiser for the Magic Million sales and for racing in Australia. And we're lucky to have her. She's in the far lap class and all of that. And it's interesting, the best one in Japan right now is a filly as well. And maybe the best one in Europe is a filly. So you've got these three great queens, if you like. But there's no doubt that she's a great flag bearer, and it very much gives emphasis to how good the stock here now is.
So interesting to hear from John Gosden, head of international bloodstock for Godolphin, speaking to Hilary Castle.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Let's take a look over the fence for a moment. A big week in weaner cattle sales in Victoria is wrapping up today. And according to agents, prices have been reasonably solid given the absence of northern buyers. Restockers in New South Wales and Queensland usually set the pace at the Western Victoria District annual weaner sales, but drought has kept them at home this year. Craig Pertzel, livestock manager with Kerr & Co. in Hamilton, says offerings have been excellent.
Numbers have been slightly up on the last few years. The Monday Angus sale, probably an extra 400 or 500 cattle come forward this year than what's been coming over the last 3 or 4 years. And it would be one of the most outstanding yardings of Angus steers that we've seen in Hamilton for quite some time.
Now, talking about that Monday Angus sale, I understand a lot of those were bought by exporters.
The Landmark International export order took roughly 1,000 head of cattle out of that sale, out of 3,500. Yeah, they were very, very strong.
Where else has the demand been? Has it been local, or have we seen interstate? And I also imagine that to the north there wouldn't be too much demand given the dry conditions up there.
No, we only saw one New South Wales plate come into the car park on Monday, and he bought a load of cattle and one on Tuesday. So and also another one on Wednesday. But that's very few and far between the New South Wales orders this year. But competition's been pretty strong from the abattoirs that run their own feedlots and people that are backgrounding cattle for those programs and things like that. So the southeast of South Australia and Gippsland and local orders have covered most of the cattle this year.
Now, talking prices, where have we been sitting? Are we sort of either side of that 300-cent mark?
Yeah, pretty well spot on. Monday's sale, I think, averaged 312 cents across the nearly 3,600 head. It topped at 331 cents, so it was a pretty good result. The sale on that was for Angus steers on the Monday. On the Tuesday, there was Angus, Hereford and Euros, the Charolais, Limousins and Simmentals. They've averaged for their nearly 3,000 head, 302 cents, with a top of 330. The Angus steers averaging around 310 that day, which was very similar to the day before, and the Hereford's about 299 cents. So, yeah, pretty consistent over the last couple of days. And then moving along onto Wednesday, the Hereford steers there averaged $3 for 1,500 of them and a top of 316. The Euros, the 600 Euro steers averaged 297 with a top of 330, and the 500 Euro heifers averaged 280 with a top of 336. So it's been pretty consistent. Either side of $3 has covered most of the cattle, yeah.
And what's the feedback been from the sellers? Are they reasonably happy with those prices?
Oh, I think so, given everyone's very aware of how tough it's been in the north. And I recall over many years of reading the stock and land and the like that quite often you've seen the map of Australia or the map of Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia and Tassie and the arrows all flying to the north where the cattle are going. Well, there'd be only one little arrow this year, and it's been very noticeable, the lack of northern competition. But, yeah, you know, look, the sellers, their producers have been very happy with what they've got there. There's been a lot of weight in the calves this year. I think the first day they averaged 348 kilos, so 340 on the Tuesday. So there's been a fair bit of weight in the calves, and you multiply that by the three and a bit, $3.05, and that whatever it's averaged across the whole lot, I suppose you're coming out with the steers averaging between, you know, $1,000 and $1,100, and the heifers between probably $750 to $850 in that range. So that's where they'll mostly will sit, I would think.
So maybe a pleasant surprise for those prices to be where they're at, given that there has been almost a total lack of buyers out of the north.
Put it this way, it could have been a hell of a lot worse.
And another sale in Hamilton yesterday. What results did we see there?
Angus heifers traded at from 250 to 265 a kilo, with a top of 282 that went back to go back to the bull. And the Herefords have traded between 245 and 255 in the main, once again with a top few pens up to 293, a few isolated pens going back to the bulls as well.
Always interesting to hear Victoria prices. Craig Pertzel from Kerr & Co in Hamilton speaking with Angus Varley. Central Queensland cattle agents are back into it also, with the Gracemere cattle sale underway. Richard Thompson reports 4 score cows averaged 234 cents a kilo.
Good afternoon, Amy. Good afternoon, listeners. Gracemere agents offered 980 head for their first sale of the year. The numbers were depleted due to some heavy falls of rain in the local area. It was useful quality offering with very few slaughter cattle available due to local plants not being open yet. The buying panel was similar to the normal, except for a few who did not operate due to the lack of numbers. Prices generally eased, with some of the cows being a little better. Cattle were drawn from Collinsville through to the Dawson area and also Mount Larkham, with a few local cattle on offer as well. Heavy yielding steers sold at 284 and averaged 269, with light and plainer pens making to the mid to 50 cent range. Yearling heifers averaged from 237 to 250. There were insufficient growing steers and heifers to quote. 4 score cows sold to 235 and averaged 234. Heavy bulls made 235. And a few cows and calves on offer made 1,025 per unit. This has been Richard Thompson for the National Livestock Reporting Service of the MLA.
Now let's check in with Les Klein, who's got livestock markets overall this week.
Good afternoon, Amy. The first sale in Toowoomba for the new year attracted only 257 prime cattle, mainly yearlings, which were snapped up by restockers and punters. Light steers sold at 297.2 cents live. They averaged 286 cents. Medium weight yearlings sold from 291 up to 296 cents. The heifer component ranged from 255 to average 249 cents. A few heavier heifers to 277.2. Plain flat score 3 cows sold around 198 cents. There was no pork or bacon at the Harristown pig sale. However, sows made to $116, forward store pigs to $150 per head. Weaner pigs sold to $120 and sucker pigs to $80. The other major centre this week was Warwick, which sold 964 head on Tuesday, young cattle dominated, plus a few cows. Veal or steers to local butchers sold at 297.2, with light yielding steers making 303 cents, for an average of 292. A few to the trade sold to 310 cents. Heavy steers to export slaughter made to 290.6, with a few heavy cows selling around 240 cents. Les Klein in Brisbane reporting for the Country Hour.
Thank you, Les. Just some rain, 307 millimetres for the week at South Hill Serena, 305 at Pinnacle in the Pioneer Valley. It's news time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.